Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
A disturbing story came to me in my inbox yesterday, actually. A friend of mine sent an email saying, hey, can you check this out? Tell me if this is real or not. If it is, this is a really sad thing to come across. It was just a simple URL he sent me, savejames.com. Clicked on it. It appears to be a website that was created by friends of a father who was involved in a custody dispute with his ex-wife over the fate of their son, James, and whether James will receive hormones and castrating surgery for him to live as a girl, as his mother claims he wants to live, in opposition to his father, who says that little James identifies as being a boy. So I tracked the story back and saw that there was a longer article about this in The Federalist, as published on November 26th by Walt Heyer. Walt runs several websites. Walt is most known for sexchangeregret.com. Walt used to identify as a woman, regretted going through a sex change operation, and now identifies as a man. And he talks about other people who are victimized by those who are obsessed with transgender ideology. So this is what Walt says. 6-year-old James is caught in a gender identity nightmare. Under his mom's care in Dallas, Texas, James obediently lives as a trans girl named Luna. But given the choice when he's with dad, he's all boy, his sex at birth. In their divorce proceedings, the mother has charged the father with child abuse for not affirming James is transgender. I wonder why the father doesn't charge the mom with abuse for not affirming reality. She has sought restraining orders against him and is seeking to terminate his parental rights. She is also seeking to require him to pay for the child's visits to a transgender-affirming therapist and transgender medical alterations, which may include hormonal sterilization starting at age 8. And Walt goes on to say, you know, Walt doesn't support any of this, but he says that even in this particular case, the child does not qualify. No child should qualify, of course, for this, but the child wouldn't even qualify under our own world standards for so-called sex reassignment surgery. And do remember, ladies and gentlemen, language is important when we talk about this. If we get the language wrong, we kind of cede over 50% of the game to the other side. So that's why when I'm talking about things our culture puts forward as falsehoods that undermine the dignity of the human person, that undermine the institution of marriage, I usually use phrases like self-identified or so-called to acknowledge this is just a term the other side uses. I don't believe in its veracity. So, for example, I try very hard not to say sex reassignment surgery or gender reassignment surgery because I do not believe it is possible for you to go through surgery and actually change your sex from being male to female. It is not possible now for science to go in and rewrite every single piece of your genetic code and change XX to XY or vice versa. All that happens is that someone goes in, you are either, your body is prevented from developing its natural sex traits, such as using hormone blockers in girls who claim to be boys so they don't develop breasts, for example, or, you know, boys' hormone blockers to prevent them from developing testosterone, or giving them facsimiles, fakes, that prosthetics that are supposed to replicate the sexual organs of the other sex. And we'll talk about a sad case involving that with a article in the New York Times that was published recently. So Walt goes on to say, he describes what the dad says about what's going on with his son, James. Walt says, the criteria for a diagnosis of childhood gender dysphoria are that a child be persistent, consistent, and insistent about being the opposite sex. James's mom is all in on the diagnosis of gender dysphoria and assisting with social transition. She used the name Luna to enroll him as a girl in first grade and provides only female clothes. Meanwhile, dad isn't seeing signs of gender dysphoria. In the father's home, James appears to be a normal boy and doesn't identify as a girl. He has a choice of boys' or girls' clothes there. In fact, the courts have mandated that James's father is not allowed to tell him from either a religious or even a scientific perspective that James is a boy. He's not allowed to cut his hair. He's not allowed to dress him in boy clothes. He has to, here's the nice little compromise we gave for you. You can present James, or Luna, depending on what word you're going to use, two different options here. You know, the boy clothes or the girl clothes. So at dad's house, James chooses the boy clothes and then acts out boy games. Heyer goes on to say, the transition therapist, this has been written down in court documents for this case. The transition therapist has observed that James is not consistent, insistent, or persistent. in the desire to become Luna. For example, a dossier filed with the Dallas court says that under the skilled eyes of the therapist, the child was presented two pieces of paper, one with the word James and one with the word Luna, and asked to pick the name he preferred. When the appointment only included his mother, James selected Luna, the name and gender he uses at his mother's home and in his first grade class. When the appointment was only with his father, however, James pointed to the boy name named James, not the girl name. I mean, this has, you know, two elements, of course, that are sad in this. One is the issue of gender identity and transgender identity in children as young as, 6 years old. That we would not, there's a lot of six-year-olds who would say that they are Scar from The Lion King or that they are a dinosaur. Do we take them seriously? They're still trying to, what does someone, a child who has not entered puberty yet, know what it means to be a boy or a girl? Because that idea, but that puberty is such a radical change to the body, if you remember. And I remember with, certainly didn't we all, like 98% of us who had an awkward puberty experience, and then the other 2% in middle school that we all hated, that we're not awkward, but we're just taller or better looking than the rest of us, for the rest of us people, the common people. It's just childhood, when you're 5 or 6 years old, everything's simple. You don't even really notice the big differences between boys and girls. And there aren't really that significant. Obviously, there are different genitalia, but there are not that many significant biological sex differences between boys and girls the age 5 or 6 versus when you get to 13, 14, 17, 18, when puberty hits, where it's just, clear sex differences can be seen. So how does someone know what it means to be a boy or means to be a girl when they have not hit that experience yet? That is what we have to bring up, and that's what I wanted to focus today on today's show, talking about how to protect our children from transgender ideologues. That I've heard stories from friends saying, you know, that their son draws himself wearing, I heard a story about this, I don't know if it was a friend or it was a story that I heard, but I remember a distinct element that one, you know, the boy draws himself with a purple LA Lakers jersey in drawings of himself, and the teacher says, oh, he's drawing himself with a dress, he must be a girl. And then you go to the school counselor, and then if you say, well, no, he doesn't think he's a girl, guess what? You're on the watch list. Maybe your kid will get taken away from you because you were a child abuser. That should make us very that this is happening now. I strongly suggest you reconsider putting your children in government schools. I don't even like using the word public schools, because really what it is, they're government schools run by agents of the government. Now, look, I'm not getting into conspiracy theories or things like that, but they promote a very particular agenda, and they do so forcefully. Here in California, students are now not allowed to opt out of sex education classes in government schools that promote transgender ideology, which means probably 90% chance we won't enroll our children in government education because I don't want them learning things. Here's why. I don't want them learning things that are false, like the false idea that male and female are just states of mind, are just attitudes instead of being biological realities. So we'll have a lot more. We have a lot more resources for that. Also, I'm probably going to upload a interview soon with my co-author, Layla Miller, at least an update for us. We're going to visit EWTN to talk about her book, Made This Way, which covers transgender identity. If you don't have it, I do recommend it. It's a great resource. I'm not just saying that because I'm the co-author. So I should have some bonus materials for that uploaded to the podcast website, by the way. If you want to check those out and become a premium subscriber, do visit trendhornpodcast.com because I want to give you guys as many resources on these issues as possible. And I want to keep the podcast going to reach a lot of people. So consider making a monthly donation as low as $5. You get access to all that bonus content at trendhornpodcast.com. You go on there. My most recent bonus content is an interview I did with my friend Brandon Vocht for Claritas University on the issue of abortion. So I hope that you'll check that out. Now, back to the story at hand. What do we do when people bring up this transgender ideology and say that even children as young as 5 or 6 might need to consider gender transitioning? Well, first, along with starting with our bedrock of science, say, no, we should look at the facts as the facts and not be swayed by people's personal opinions, we can look at other studies that have been done that show, on average, 80% of children who identify as the other gender or do not identify as their biological sex cease to identify that way as they get older, as they go past puberty. that, I mean, it makes sense that once you enter puberty, then you really have an understanding of your body. Now, I think that people who still identify as transgender after puberty are incorrect because male and female is not a purely subjective attitude. But even people on the other side would agree with us. Even someone committed transgender ideology would say we should not transition someone, quote unquote, give them sex reassignment surgery if there is a good chance that later in life they will identify with their original biological sex. It would do them harm. A good article for this was published in June of last year at The Stranger. It's an article by Katie Herzig called The Detransitioners. They were transgender until they weren't. And this is talking about people, a phenomenon of people who have essentially a mental illness or a mental disorder. And I'm going to say transgender identity is a mental disorder. You will not be accepted in polite company in certain parties in Los Angeles and New York to say transgender identity is a mental disorder. It's a cardinal sin in the secular world today. But I'm sorry, an identity disorder occurs when you think you're something you're not. If you think that you are paralyzed and you're not, you have body integrity identity disorder. If you think you are a morbidly obese person, but you're actually emaciated and underweight, you have anorexia nervosa. You have an identity disorder. If you are a man who thinks you're a woman or vice versa, that's an identity disorder. It's a sad thing. We should have compassion for people who don't feel well in their own skin or their own body, and they have this kind of dysphoria or negative feeling in their own body. We should have compassion for them, but not feed into the disorder that they have. So this is what it says. This is an excerpt from the Detransitioners. Herzig says, despite the differences in country, culture, decade, and follow-up length and method, all the studies have come to a remarkably similar conclusion. Only very few trans kids still want to transition by the time they are adults. Instead, they generally turn out to be regular gay or lesbian folks. So that's Herzig quoting a Canadian sex researcher. Herzig then says, so to go back to that, what happens here, you have people, some of these detransitioners, they are women who have some form of clinical depression. They might have had a traumatic experience, could have been sexual assault, could have been something else. And they feel that the key to getting over their dysphoria, this depression, is to become a man. Then they become a man, they take testosterone supplements and realize being a man, it's not a man's world after all. It's being a man, dealing with testosterone, dealing with male hormones, it ain't easy. And they realize becoming a man, quote unquote, did not solve their problems. So they transition, quote unquote, transition back. So Herzog goes on to say the exact rate of desistance varied by study, but overall, they concluded that about 80% of trans kids eventually identified as their sex at birth. So she goes on, she describes Brian Tannehill from the Huffington Post saying that that's just a myth promoted by, he says, reparative therapists, concern trolls, and charlatans. But Herzig, to her credit, goes on to say, but the most recent study published in 2013 in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry followed up with 127 adolescent patients at a gender identity clinic in Amsterdam. And the Netherlands, of course, are super hospitable, one of the most hospitable places for people who identify as LGBTQIA, you know, through the whole acronym. Yet even there, even in very affirming countries like the Netherlands, people who identify as LGBT still have the same above average levels of mental illness and mental disorders than other people. Because people will tell you that depression, mental illnesses among those who identify as LGBT, that's caused by persecution and bigots, you know, bigots like me apparently, that's what causes that. Yet when you go to places that are very affirming like the Netherlands or go to Scandinavia, you still see those same rates. So maybe perhaps it is the fact that the person has disordered sexual orientation, disordered sense of identity. Maybe that is what is causing them to have this dysphoria and these other negative maladies. So what this shows here is that a lot of people, when they take this ideology, they're not going to be content at stopping at, well, we're going to do this because this is what people makes you happy. This is what's going to make you feel fulfilled, because people are coming out more and more saying, no, it doesn't, but they're not going to give it up. They want it because they're committed to 100% autonomy. The idea that I should be able to do whatever I want with my body, even if it's bad for me. People worship the idol of autonomy. I want to do what I want. I don't care what it does to me. And here's the ironic thing about it, the autonomy. I want to do what I want to do. if you won't help me, I'm going to sue you into oblivion or ostracize you. So people have unlimited autonomy, except when they want to refuse to take part in things like sex reassignment surgery. Instead, there, a doctor should not be able to refuse a patient. Forget your autonomy, doctor. And here's my evidence for that. There's an article that was published November 24th, 2018, in the New York Times by Andrea Long Chu, who is a biological male who claims to be a woman. And the article is called "My New Vagina Won't Make Me Happy, and It Shouldn't Have to." Okay, so we have a biological. So this is Andrea Long Chu in the article. And other people will say this is a woman, a transgender woman. This is a biological man who identifies as a woman and is going through so-called sex reassignment surgery. And part of that is to have a vagina put into his body. But of course, it's not a vagina. It's just a cavity or hole that's burrowed out in his pelvic region. And Chu admits in the article that his body will treat this. This is what he says. "Until the day I die, my body will regard the vagina as a wound. As a result, it will require regular, painful attention to maintain." Well, of course, your body's trying to heal because you're a man. There's not supposed to be a hole there. Ironically, there's a Healthline public, not ironically, just where our culture's going. Several weeks, or this was probably a few months ago, Healthline.com, a public mainstream health website, Healthline.com published an LGBTQIA safe sex guide. And in there, a lot of people picked up on this, and in conservative media, it got a lot of play, that the headlines were saying that this safe sex guide replaced the word vagina. There's a word. As one of my colleagues used to say, vagina. Replace the word vagina with the word front hole. So then I've seen other conservative commenters. So Healthline had to come out with another release saying, no, we are not replacing the word vagina with the word front hole. And that's correct. That's not what they were doing. So when we point out the inanity of some of these things that are happening in the world, when you point that out, be sure you're accurate about it. What they're doing is still inane. This is what they wrote in the original guide. They said, "For the purposes of this guide," it's a quote-unquote safe sex guide for LGBTQIA. "For the purposes of this guide, we've chosen to include alternative words for readers to use for their genitals. For example, some trans men choose to use the words," trans men being a biological, so a trans man would be a biological woman who claims to be a man, yet this person has a vagina. So this person would prefer to say, well, I don't have a vagina, I have a front hole or internal genital instead of vagina. So this usage is meant for one-on-one communication with trusted persons such as your doctor or partner, not for broad discussion. In this guide, whenever we use the medical term vagina, we'll also include front hole. So they want to say that a biological woman who has a vagina, that is on par. They want to say that it's equal and on par with a biological male that has a cavity burrowed into his pelvis and tries. But here's the thing. Here's the thing that when it comes to transgender debate that you should point out, that if male and female are purely related to identity, purely related to what we call ourselves, that if I say I am a woman, even though I have male genitalia and male genetics, that person is a woman. There was a time where it was they identify as a woman. Now it's just, no, they are a woman, and you have to agree to that. Twitter, who knows? Twitter might ban me soon because Twitter has a new rule that if you misgender someone, if you identify a transgender person by their biological sex or the pronoun or their old name, and I don't care about the name. That's not a big deal to me. People change their names all the time. But I'm not going to call someone by the incorrect biological pronoun. So who knows? We'll see how long I last on Twitter. But they say, well, they're synonymous. Well, if they're basically, if you can just call a transgender woman just is a woman, why do you even need the preface transgender? Just say there are men and there are women. Because they need to add that adjective, that modifier transgender, to explain why this particular woman is not like every other woman, biologically has very, very distinctive differences. Why can't you say that Andrea Long Chu in that article going to get a cavity surgically excised, put into his peritoneum pelvis region, why not just call that a vagina? Say, oh, well, that's a vagina. Because deep down, everybody knows it's not. It just isn't. And you can't even just say, well, it's a vagina because I say so. Because it isn't. It's not connected to a uterus. It's not connected to a fallopian tube. It's not naturally designed for reception of the male member ordered towards the creation of a new human life. It is has to have the ignominious name of a front hole. So here, I want to go on and read more of what Chu wrote in this New York Times op-ed. So Chu says, as long as transgender medicine retains the, Chu, at least to his credit, admits that transition and surgery has a lot of drawbacks. And for him, it's probably, it's overwhelming. He talks about how taking estrogen makes him want to cry 6 to 8 hours a day. I was not suicidal before hormones. Now often I am. I won't go through with it, probably killing is icky. I tell you this not because I'm cruising for sympathy, but to prepare you for what I'm telling you now. I still want this, all of it. I want the tears. I want the pain. Transition doesn't have to make me happy for me to want it. Left to their own devices, people will rarely pursue what makes them feel good in the long term. Desire and happiness are independent agents. And it's just sad that Chu says he wants this sex reassignment surgery. It makes him miserable just because he wants it. And he demands that doctors respect this. So he writes, the medical maxim, first do no harm, assumes that healthcare providers possess both the means and the authority to decide what counts as harm. When doctors and patients disagree, the exercise of this prerogative can itself be harmful. Non-maleficence is a principle, or to not do bad to someone, don't harm them, which is one of the most ancient principles of medicine, by the way. Non-maleficence is a principle violated in its very observation. Its true purpose is not to shield patients from injury, but to install the medical professional as a little king of someone else's body. So what's weird is that a medical professional, if he or she says, you know what, I am not going to drill a cavity into your peritoneum and call it a vagina because it isn't, and I'm going to create a gaping wound that's going to keep wanting to heal itself and it's going to harm you, and you've told me it's going to cause you harm for the rest of your life, I'm not going to take part in that. Or even in a more mundane case, you have a doctor, a woman who is 21 years old, comes to him and says, I want a salpingectomy. I want my fallopian tubes removed because I'm never going to have kids. I want you to do it tomorrow. And he says, you know, I'm not going to permanently remove your fertility. A lot of doctors, even those who do sterilizations, will say, I want you to think it over for at least a week or two. Not going to say, yeah, hop right on in. We'll, you know, we'll get it done as fast as I can make you a quarter pounder with cheese. You know, I'll make it your way. This is the Burger King Women's Health Office. No, people want to turn the medical profession, medical professionals, instead of people. Now, sometimes medical professionals can have God complexes. I admit that. They're not infallible. They can lord their authority. That's why it's always important to get a second opinion. But at the same time, what modern secular culture wants to do in changing the nature of the human body and not recognizing its natural design wants to turn doctors just into tools for our use to promote the principle of autonomy at the detriment to other principles like the principle of do no harm. Chu even says, point blank, I believe that surgery's only prerequisite should be a simple demonstration of want. And we should point out that would overturn decades of our understanding in bioethics. Hey, that's what I'm studying right now. You might have heard about on last week's show. It would overturn decades of understanding that doctors are there for our to act in our best interest. And sometimes we don't always act in our best interest. Isn't that right? Aren't you glad sometimes that other people, you've wanted to make a rash decision and other people said, I'm not going to help you do that? As human beings, we care for one another and want to help one another. And in order to love one another and to care for the well-being of other people, sometimes that, you know, we always say, oh, we should support one another. Right. But sometimes that to love another person is to tell them, no, not going to help you. Because I love you, you drank too much last night, I hid your keys, I'm not letting you get in that car. You know, we do that all the time. I'm not going to support you doing X, which will involve damaging repercussions for the rest of your life, whatever it may be. That's what it means to love someone, is not to simply say, oh, well, they're an autonomous agent. I'm going to facilitate everything they want to do. But love at its core means to will the good for another person. Here's, as our time comes to a close, talking about transgender identity, there's another one of our supporters. This is a woman who has purchased 6 cases, I think, of Made This Way, my book with Layla Miller on how to explain tough moral issues to children, and has passed them out nonstop. She talked about how she sent me an email saying, you know, we rely on certain analogies with children to show them transgender ideology is absurd. Like, you know, if you just saying you're a cat doesn't make you a cat. She worries that might not be the case anymore. It may not be the case. And there's a book that she showed me, sent me a link to, that was released on June 12, 2018 by Jason Flom and his daughter Allison. Jason Flom is, I think, CEO of Lava Records. So he's a record industry executive. And it's called Lulu is a Rhinoceros. Lulu is a rhinoceros. The description of the book: everyone thinks Lulu is a bulldog, but she knows that can't be true because Lulu is a rhinoceros. That is what she sees staring back at her when she looks in the mirror. But sometimes being yourself can be a difficult road to walk. And just when all hope seems lost, Lulu finds a small friend that makes a big difference in her life when she realizes that the courage to be herself has been inside of her all along. So this is actually quite insidious. It's a book, Lulu the Bulldog. The cover is a little bulldog. And there's just something about bulldogs. I have a friend who once said that if he ever got pets, he would get a bulldog and a corgi. Because the corgi was just this little smart, lovable dog that dances on his hind legs. And he'd just walk in saying to the bulldog, "Why do you look like such an idiot, bulldog? Quit peeing on the bed, stupid." Because you know? Bulldogs are like, I don't know, they're just like these lovable scamps that don't look like they're all completely there, you know? But I guess, hey, some people like bulldogs and others don't. So the story is Lulu is a bulldog, looks in the mirror, thinks he's a rhinoceros. And when the story goes on, Lulu goes, and it's obviously part of it's a metaphor for transgender identity. I think what Flom, his main purpose in writing the book, though, was to raise awareness for endangered rhinos. I think that was actually, when you read the interviews with him, that's the main purpose. But transgender identity is huge because when Lulu goes out to other dogs and says, "Hi, I'm a rhinoceros," the other dogs say, "Eek, are you some kind of freak? Do you think I can't see? You don't look like one to me." No one's like, "Oh, Lulu, why do you think you're a rhinoceros? Why would you think that? Or you're a very beautiful bulldog. And what you see is not, you know, that's not you in the mirror, but the you who is really you is beautiful." You know, we don't get any of that. So we have to be concerned that when it comes to young children, to close the loop here on the show, it began with little James, who is 6 years old, missed this custody battle. But transgender ideology is being pushed. All this ideology is being pushed to kids younger and younger and younger. So we have to be prepared to instill in them. So Lulu is a rhinoceros instills one particular value. In an interview on this book, Flom says that one of the values he wanted to instill in his kids through books like this is never be on the side of the oppressor and do whatever you can without necessarily putting yourself in harm's way to help the oppressed. This is classic secular liberal thinking, that in the world there's only two kinds of people. There are the oppressors and the oppressed. And someone who is in the minority, identifies as LGBT, is oppressed. Do everything you can to help them. Don't listen to the mean old oppressors over here. So we have to instill in our kids a different message, a message saying that we ought to practice virtues, honesty, courage, do what's right, even if people disagree with us, to promote the truth, even if people won't accept it, and to love others, even if they won't love us back. Though we have to instill these messages in kids early on and to teach them not to go with the crowd. So I've even thought about writing, you know, pray for me, I'm going to discern this a little. I want to write little kids' stories. I mean, you know, I have children. I mean, I might even just write them for them, honestly. William Lane Craig is a Protestant philosopher who wrote stories about God for his own kids. I might write stories for my children to instill these values in them. I'll just find a lookout for a really good illustrator. And I got to even have one based on this transgender identity cooking in my mind. So we'll see if I can come up with something good related to that. But we should be prepared to instill the same messages in our kids. So in my book, Made This Way with Layla Miller, which I recommend you get, madethiswaybook.com, you can get a case of them, $100 for 20 books. Give them to any parent, anyone you know, grandparent, aunt, works with young kids. Because in the chapter on transgender in Made This Way, we talk about how here's a good story you should tell your kids. Tell them the story of the emperor's new clothes. It's a perfect parable related to the issue of transgender identity. In fact, I could read you, this is from Jean Herschelt's translation of The Emperor's New Clothes. Let me just read you a little bit of it just to get a feel for the story that you remember, you know, if you don't remember it. "Many years ago, there was an emperor so exceedingly fond of new clothes that he spent all his money on being well-dressed. In the great city where he lived, life was always gay." Truer words are never spoken, though it was written 150 years ago. Every day, many strangers came to town, and among them, one day came two swindlers. That was not, by the way, that was not a dig at people who identify as LGBT. I'm just saying that people who promote LGBT ideology in these particular big bustling cities are the ones who will promote this transgender ideology. One day came two swindlers. They let it be known they were weavers. They said they could weave the most magnificent fabrics imaginable. Not only were their colors and patterns uncommonly fine, but the clothes made out of this cloth had a wonderful way of becoming invisible to anyone who was unfit for his office or who was unusually stupid. Remember, this is a translation of the original Hans Christian Andersen, The Emperor's New Clothes. The emperor says, "Those would be just fine for me. If I could wear clothes like that, I would know who's unfit and foolish in my kingdom." So later on, he goes and the emperor goes and sees the weavers. They make the clothes for him. And the weavers have already duped his minister, have duped other people. He found them. So the emperor goes, he found the two swindlers weaving with might and main, but without a thread in their looms. "Magnificent," said the two officials who had already been duped. "Just look, your majesty, what colors, what a design." They pointed to the empty looms, each supposing that the others could see the stuff. "What's this?" thought the emperor. "I can't see anything. This is terrible. Am I a fool? Am I unfit to be the emperor?" He goes along with, obviously, with the ruse because he doesn't want to seem foolish either. Then the minister of public processions announced, "Your majesty's canopy is waiting outside." And they go on the parade through town. And the nobleman who carried his train stooped low and reached for the floor as if they were picking up his mantle. They pretended to lift and hold it high. They didn't dare admit they had nothing to hold. Everyone in the streets and the windows said, "Oh, how fine are the emperor's new clothes. Don't they fit him to perfection?" Nobody would confess he couldn't see anything, for that would prove him either unfit for his position or a fool. "But he hasn't got anything on," a little child said. "Did you ever hear such innocent prattle?" said its father. And one person whispered to another what the child said. "He hasn't anything on. A child says he hasn't anything on, but he hasn't got anything on," the whole town cried out at last. And then the story ends. The emperor shivered, for he suspected they were right. But he thought, "This procession has got to go on." So he walked more proudly than ever, and his noblemen held high the train that wasn't there at all. So who are you going to be? The villagers that go along with the ruse, or the child who courageously stands up and speaks the truth? I hope you will speak the truth, and I hope you've enjoyed your time here at the Council of Trent podcast. You all have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.